Well, good evening. Can I welcome you again? Thank you very much for being here this evening. My name is Charlie Screen. I'm one of the clergy on the staff team here. Let me just tell you the format for this evening. Dr. Gary Williams is going to be speaking to us in just a few minutes. He'll speak until about 8 o'clock. Then we will break for some more drinks, a little bit more food. And during that time, there'll be a chance for you to write down questions that you can ask Gary. You should find a slip like this on every chair, along with some other things and some pens. And that if a question comes to you during the talk about anything that Gary says or about anything at all to do with Christianity, he's best on that sort of thing. Any other areas? Christianity mainly. If you would write questions down on there and we'll collect those up and I'll put those to him later on. I'd like now that, Gary, would you just come up and join me? Gary and his wife Fiona I have known for a very long time, and Gary is a good friend of St. Helens here. I first knew Gary when I was an undergraduate, and he was finishing his doctorate at Queen's College, Oxford, and got to know Gary then. Since then, he's been teaching church history at a theological college in North London, at Oak Hill Theological College in North London. I had the pleasure of studying there and suffering Gary's intensely difficult exam questions and meticulous marking. So I'm really looking forward, actually, to asking him your questions. Please don't hold back. Write down whatever you want. I will. I'll make them harder. Gary, though, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Very glad you're here. Just some easy questions to start with, though. Gary, tell me, how did you first get interested in the Da Vinci Code? How did that start?
Every couple of years, I take a team of students out from the college to a church somewhere in the country to run a week of events a bit like this, a week of events dealing with issues surrounding the Christian faith for people who might be interested in them. And one of these was coming up, and the church got in touch and said, would you do a talk on the Da Vinci Code for it? In fact, I think previously, you may even have asked me, and I think I'd said, no, I won't. And then they got in touch, and I was going to have to take this team of students out anyway, and so I thought, well, I'm going to have to do something, so why not read this book and write a talk on it? So it was for that week that I first did a talk like this, about a year and a half ago now.
So it turns out we are the first group ever to ask you, but I know we aren't the only place you've spoken. You've spoken a few different places. What else have you done on the Da Vinci Code? Where else have you been?
I've been north, east and south, not very far west, but northeast and south for talks like this, events like this. I did a bit of a television debate. It was very short, it has to be said. It was a kind of soundbite debate with Richard Lee, who's one of the authors of the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which I will mention later on. It's one of the books behind Dan Brown's book, and some radio slots as well about the Da Vinci Code and the claims in it and whether they stand up to the evidence of history or not.
I had no idea till this afternoon. Famous celebrity. With us. That's very good. Yeah, Gary, you've also written a book. Yeah. Is that right? I described this as a pamphlet to Gary earlier, and he was a bit cross about that. But a very good book. We have some copies of this here at very cheap prices. They'll be available at the end. One final question, Gary, just slightly harder. Warm up for later on. But you stand here as a Christian, but also as a historian. And I guess people may be asking, surely there's a bias there. You're a Christian. You'll be talking like a Christian. Why should we bother listening to you?
There's certainly bias is a word with overtones, isn't it? There's a conviction there, certainly. And I think you'd then want to ask yourself, will you ever find anyone who is conviction-free? And I think the answer is no, especially when it comes to such a big question as Jesus Christ and who he was and the Bible and the church and things like that. But also, I think you want to ask, well, are this man's convictions based on evidence or not? And certainly that's what we're going to be asking of Dan Brown. And I would invite everyone here who maybe thinks, surely he's a Christian historian, he would be saying these things, wouldn't he, to scrutinize the evidence that I give you this evening. And if the evidence doesn't stand up, then clearly there's nothing in it. But the Christian beliefs I hold, I have in part because there's very good evidence for them.
Thank you. Gary, I'm going to leave you the stage and people in your hands.
Thank you, Charlie. Has anyone here seen the film of the Da Vinci Code. Stick a hand up if you've seen the film, just to get a measure of how many have. Quite a lot of you have. So I'll make some reference to the film as we go, because one of the interesting things about the film is the way that it changes some of the things in the book. So I will, at various points, say, Dan Brown says this in the book. And if you've only seen the film, for example, you may well think, well, that's not what the film said, and you'll be right, probably, because they've backed off a bit at various points in the film. But thinking about the novel, which is going to consume our attention this evening, there's no doubt, is there, that this is a hugely successful novel. The statistics speak for themselves. It has been or is being translated into apparently 40 languages around the world. On a number of occasions when I've done an evening like this, somebody's come up to me afterwards from another country, one man from India came up to me and said, all of my friends at home are reading this book and talking about it. It's a global phenomenon. It's made Dan Brown an incredible amount of money as well. I have the statistics for the amount that it had apparently earned him by the end of 2004. So bear in mind that this is about a year and a half ago now, and we've had the film and other things since. But by then, apparently, it had made him £140 million. So you can only imagine how much he's made since then. And then there are the reviews, aren't there? And they rather helpfully quote a lot of these reviews inside the covers of the book, and at least in my edition. I'm working from this paperback edition, and this one's got lots of reviews in it. I'll give you one example. The New York Times says the word is wow. And Salon.com, in what I think is probably meant to be a compliment, though I admit that if anybody ever said this about a book I'd written, I would be slightly not so pleased. It would be a bit like calling it a pamphlet, for example. Salon.com called it the pulp must read of the season. Now, it's clear why people like the book, isn't it? It's a page turner. It's a gripping read. It's the kind of book that you can easily read on the train on the way into work, by the pool or the beach on holiday in those spare moments. It'll hold your attention and the pages will turn as if by themselves. But there's also a bit more to this novel than that, isn't there? It's a bit more than some of the other authors we could name who write these kinds of thrillers. I suspect that some readers feel when they read this book that they've been initiated into a great ancient secret that stretches back through the centuries, a secret which has been closely guarded by people through the centuries, but which has now been revealed by Dan Brown and told to them. But then we also know that not everybody is quite so positive about this book, and I guess obvious categories of people who aren't so positive spring to mind. But let me give you the words of two critics in an extremely negative reaction to the novel. They write this in one of the many books about the book. The Da Vinci Code is custom-made fiction for our time. Pretentious, posturing, self-serving, arrogant, self-congratulatory, condescending, glib, illogical, superficial, and deviant. You get the slight impression that they didn't enjoy it. Why? Why is it that this novel has provoked such negative reactions from so many people? I take it that it's obvious, isn't it? It is the way that Dan Brown attempts to rewrite the history of Jesus Christ, to give a new account, or at least a relatively new account, of who Jesus was and what he did, and a new account of the Bible and where it came from, and certain aspects of the history of the church. And it is that rewriting that he does which is going to be the focus of our attention this evening. Before we get into the detail, though, I think I should probably deal with a thought which may arise in people's minds as they consider thinking about the Da Vinci Code as an exercise. I certainly know this arises in many people's minds when they consider that. It's the thought, but come on, just don't take it so seriously. It's a novel. It's a bit of fiction. Why would you ever, for example, lay on an evening and get a speaker in to talk about a novel? You wouldn't do that with a Geoffrey Archer novel, to pluck an example out of the air. Why would you do it with this book? Let me give you four quick reasons why I think we can't sidestep the issues that the book raises by saying that. First of all, that is not what many readers of the book think. I could tell you some stories of evenings when I've done this kind of talk, and I've met many people, intelligent and educated people, who take this book very seriously and who are convinced by the history of Jesus Christ that it gives them. Perhaps less seriously, let me give you a couple of quotations from the BBC website to make the point. Here is Rob from Stafford. He's not here, is he? Then I will continue. The claims in the Da Vinci Code are just as plausible as the claims in the Bible. And this is the one that you really wouldn't want to have if he was here, and in fact I removed it when I went to Sheffield to do this talk. Stephen from Sheffield says, "If so many people believe it to be true, then how can it be fiction?" You see why, for Stephen's sake, I removed it. They're not exactly profound comments, are they? Many people believe all sorts of things. That tells us nothing about whether they're true or false. But the comments do show us how many readers are taking this novel. Secondly, many reviewers take the novel seriously, and perhaps you might think they should know better. Many of the same reviews inside the covers greet this as an intelligent piece of work. The New York Daily News tells us, "His research is impeccable." Thirdly, Dan Brown wants us to take it seriously too. When he's interviewed, he's normally asked, "Do you really believe all of this stuff about Jesus and Mary Magdalene being married? Are you convinced of it yourself? Surely you don't actually think that, do you?" Let me give you his words from one of those interviews. "I was skeptical, but after a year and a half of research, I became a believer." Now, the cynical among us may think that he's just saying this to try to push up sales, to cause a bit more kerfuffle by saying he really does believe it. But the fact is, he's still saying that, and he is still encouraging people to take the book in that way. And then lastly, and perhaps most significantly of all, there are the books behind the book. Now, this wasn't so obvious until the lawsuit recently, when two of the authors of the book, The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, Michael Bagent and Richard Lee, tried to sue Dan Brown for some kind of intellectual theft, for stealing the ideas in their book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. In fact, he does acknowledge the book at one point in the section, that long section where most of the material about Jesus comes in the middle of the novel. He does give a few titles of books which set out the kinds of theories that his characters are setting out. But the important point is this, that these books are not novels. They're not fiction. The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail claims to give a plausible reading of history, a hypothesis which Richard Lee has said he thinks is more plausible than the view of history that you get in the Gospels in the New Testament. So these books are, I would say, pseudo-historical books. They would say historical books. They claim to be exposés about the truth about Jesus Christ and who he was. So for those reasons then, for this evening at least, let's take the Da Vinci Code as a book which gives us a view of history, which claims to give a truer account of history than the Gospels of the New Testament do. And let's weigh its claims as such. Now, when I get into debates and discussions with people, a particular style of arguing I find very frustrating. You might call it the sort of machine gun fire style of arguing. I'm sure you've experienced it. You've probably even done it. It's that kind of argument where somebody fires something at you and you begin to explain how you would answer that and you lay out your reasons and your evidence, etc., etc. And then suddenly, just as you're a few sentences in, they say, but what about this? And they fire another unrelated point at you. And you begin to deal with that one. And then another one, and another one, another one comes. And you can't possibly keep up with them. And you feel like that man in the Matrix trying to dodge all of these bullets that are coming past you. And it's just hopeless you can't do it. And it's a deliberate tactic, isn't it, to avoid actually scrutinizing anything seriously and in a sustained fashion. It's a particularly cheap kind of argument, which, nonetheless, I'm going to employ at the outset this evening. Let me just rattle through some quick-fire examples of simple errors of fact committed by Dan Brown in the course of the Da Vinci Code. Errors of fact which perhaps suggest that he doesn't really know quite what he's doing, that maybe he is, after all, piecing things together from a variety of other sources, though, of course, I don't want to comment on the legalities of it. So Dan Brown says that the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi Library texts, on which more later, are the earliest Christian records. But the Dead Sea Scrolls contain no Christian content at all. It's a variety of Judaism that's behind the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dan Brown says that the divinity of Jesus Christ, the full deity of Jesus Christ, was voted on at the Council of Nicaea in 325 and was agreed by, I quote, a close vote. Well, there are about 250 bishops present at this council voting, and only two of them voted against the idea. Brown says that Pope Clement V threw the ashes of the burnt Knights Templar into the River Tiber, which is at Rome, in his campaign against them. But Clement was Pope at Avignon from 1305 to 1314 and didn't go to Rome. My favourite is that Dan Brown says that the nuns of the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception gave instructions for the painting of the Madonna of the Rocks. But there were no nuns of the Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception because it was an all-male order. Male order as in M-A-L-E, order. That's in this internet age, you never quite know, do you, what people think when you say male order. That's a particularly interesting one, because if you look on Google and you enter Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception, you will find there appears to be a modern Confraternity of the Immaculate Conception which does have nuns. And that made me wonder, was that how Dan Brown did that particular bit of research? Who knows? Lastly, though, there are the documents. The documents found at the Paris National Library, the secret dossier. These are the documents, you'll recall, which give evidence of the existence of the Priory of Sion, this institution that has guarded the bloodline of Jesus back across the centuries. And Dan Brown says they have been tested and proved authentic. But in fact, they've been proved to be a hoax. This was exposed quite a while ago by a French journalist called Jean-Luc Chaumet. If you lived in France, you would be familiar with it. It's quite a well-known hoax. But even in this country, back in 1996, the BBC put out a documentary outlining the Priory of Sion hoax. The forger of the texts, Philippe de Charissy, has himself admitted that they were forged and even described how he forged some of them. You may have noticed in the film that when Lee Teabing is in sort of full flow about all of this business and he talks about the dossier, Langdon cuts in and says, but de Charissy has admitted that they were forgeries, and it moves on very quickly, and you don't get any more than that on it. But I was interested that Richard Lee said to me when we did this debate that he did admit that perhaps they had been hoaxed by Pierre Plantard and the others behind the modern Priory of Sion idea. Now, given the importance of the Priory of Sion in the whole Dan Brown construction of history, this is pretty serious, because it is this institution, it is these documents that are claimed to demonstrate the existence and the protection of the bloodline of Jesus from the year 1099 on. If you knock them out, a fairly large hole appears in the medieval and post-medieval history that Dan Brown attempts to reconstruct. But you could, of course, say, but that's not where the action is it? The action is back in the first century AD and the early church and the Gnostics and the Gospel of Philip and the claim that Jesus was married and things like that. And that could all stand, even if you take out the Priory of Sion. And that, of course, is true. So it's that earlier period of history on which we're going to focus for the bulk of our time together this evening. What I plan to do is to give you seven claims that Dan Brown makes in the course of the novel, or that his characters make, and then to try to weigh them against the evidence of history. So let me give you the first claim. The first claim is simply that the New Testament was created by the Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century, who rejected thousands of other texts written by this group, the Gnostics. Let me give you a quotation. I'll try to give you a quotation each time to prove that Dan Brown does say this. The fundamental irony of Christianity, he writes, the Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. It's questionable, of course, whether Constantine was a pagan or a Christian. But the claim about the Bible is simply not true. It is true that Constantine asked one of his bishops, Eusebius, to produce for him 50 copies of the New Testament to be used in the new capital of his empire, Constantinople, in the east. But asking somebody to produce copies of the New Testament is not the same as being the man who gathers together these books for the first time from among thousands of others. I give you just one piece of evidence to demonstrate that the task of recognizing what books should be in the New Testament had been underway for well over 100 years before the time of Constantine. I would argue it goes back to the time of the apostles themselves. But here's a piece of evidence from the second century. It's known as the Muratorian Fragment. It is a fragment of text which lists the books that are to be received by the church as Holy Scripture. four Gospels, the first two are missing because the corner of the fragment is missing. The Acts of the Apostles, 13 Epistles of Peter, etc., etc. Now, the list is not exactly the same as the list that would finally be recognized by the church. That's not my point. My point is simply that the task of the recognition of the New Testament was well underway and significantly done over 100 years before the time of Constantine himself. And it's also very interesting that this Moratorian fragment makes a point of rejecting certain Gnostic texts, the texts of the Valentinian Gnostics. Now, this is important because on Dan Brown's picture, Constantine pops up, has a completely balanced choice between thousands of texts, goes for the ones he goes for, and now gets rid of Gnosticism. But actually, way back in the second century, we've got clear evidence that Gnosticism was being rejected in this fragment and indeed in many other ways as well. Claim number two, a bit more specific than the New Testament as a whole. Claim number two concerns the four Gospels in particular, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And Constantine claims that these four Gospels were selected from 80 others, 80 other Gospels that could have gone into the New Testament. Brown writes this, Constantine commissioned and financed a new Bible, which omitted those Gospels that spoke of Christ's human traits and embellished those Gospels that made him godlike. The earlier Gospels were outlawed, gathered up, and burned. Or again, more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion. Now, this is wrong in all sorts of ways. There are many texts, Christian texts, written, again, well before the time of Constantine, which tell us that there are and can only be four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. One example again, a man called Irenaeus, dead by about the year 200 AD, again, over 100 years before Constantine's reign as emperor. And he writes this rather intriguing argument. I'm not trying to persuade you of the merits of it. Again, have a listen, because it's a slightly puzzling kind of argument. It is not possible that the Gospels can be either more or fewer in number than they are. For since there are four zones of the world in which we live, and four principal winds, while the church is scattered throughout all the world, it is fitting that she should have four pillars. From which fact, it's evident that the Word, he means Jesus, who was manifested to men, has given us the gospel under four aspects, but bound together by one spirit. It's a funny kind of argument, isn't it? There are four winds, therefore there must be four gospels. I think you'd have to say it's not a great argument, really. But the point is this, here is Irenaeus over 100 years before the time of Constantine saying four and only four. It's also problematic even to claim that there were over 80 Gospels. To start with, most of the things that people call Gospels, you know, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, the sort of Gnostic Gospels that crop up in the weekend newspapers as the latest find or the latest theory has come out of them, most of them aren't Gospels at all. They're collections of random sayings attributed to Jesus or his followers. Whereas the Gospels, as we know them in the New Testament, are narratives of significant portions of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. So most of them aren't really Gospels anyway. But even if you do include all of those things as Gospel, the figure is more like 20 than 80. There is just no evidence that there were ever 80. I don't know where that figure can have come from. Claim number three is that at the Council of Nicaea, that great gathering of Christian leaders in the year 325, Constantine rejected the earthly Jesus. He got rid of the earthly Jesus, and he made him divine. He made him into a deity for the first time. So Brown writes this on Nicaea. Until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man, nonetheless, a mortal. Or again, he writes, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world. Now, imagine for me, please, a very, very small grain of wheat. A very small grain, and that's about the size of the grain of truth that there is in this claim about the Council of Nicaea. Because it's not entirely wrong. The true bit, this is part of the problem with Dan Brown's book, I think, and with some of these other books as well. They're full of lots of real facts. Okay, you could open up this book at many points and find lots of real, agreed, documented facts. But then they're interwoven with other things, and they're misinterpreted in various ways. So here's an example. The Council of Nicaea did affirm the full deity, the full divinity of Jesus Christ. That's true. But Brown gets it wrong in a couple of crucial ways here. First of all, belief in the full divinity of Jesus Christ had been present from the beginning of the Christian church, from the time of Jesus himself. And if you look in the Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and in other letters in the New Testament, you'll find abundant evidence for this. For example, the beginning of Mark's Gospel. Verses are taken from the Old Testament, which describe the coming of the Lord God himself. And they are applied to the coming of Jesus Christ, thereby affirming that in Jesus Christ, God has come. Jesus Christ in Mark chapter 2 claims authority to forgive sins. And he's told only God can forgive sins. And yes, that's the point. That's who he is. Paul, on a number of occasions, actually just calls Jesus God in his letters. The writer of the Hebrews calls Jesus God in his letter as well. The word that's given to Jesus, a title for him that's used very often, the title Lord, is the name of God in the Old Testament, applied freely to Jesus in this exalted fashion. So the New Testament itself shows that the Christians believed in the full divinity of Jesus Christ from the beginning. Then if you step outside the New Testament and you come to the early church writers, you find again abundant evidence for belief in the divinity of Christ. A man called Ignatius of Antioch, dead by the year 107, writes this of Jesus: very flesh, human, yet spirit too. Uncreated. Who is the only uncreated being? It's a claim for his divinity. And yet born, his humanity. God and man in one agreed. So the New Testament and the early church writers, well before the time of Constantine, affirm the full humanity of Jesus, but also his full divinity, his full deity. Secondly, Dan Brown is wrong in what he says about Nicaea, when he claims that the four Gospels that do go into the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, downplay the humanity of Jesus Christ. Okay, he says that there Constantine puts them in because he wants an exalted divine Jesus and wants to downplay the human Jesus. That's why he has these four Gospels. Now, I need to say to you this evening, I don't know how anyone can think that. At a number of points this evening, I'm just going to have to meet the things that this novel says with stark incredulity. I simply cannot comprehend how somebody can say that about the four Gospels. But before we get into the detail, I want to ask you all a question, and I'm not going to ask you to answer it out loud, but I want to ask you this, for you to answer to yourself. When did you last sit down and, with an adult mind, read from cover to cover one of the Gospels in the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John? When did you last do that? Now, for many of you, no doubt, the answer will be, not just the Christians here, for many of the answer will be that you did that fairly recently. But I suspect that for a fairly significant number of people here, the answer will be, well, actually, now that I stop and think about it, I've never done that. I've never done that. I know I got through a pretty decent education without ever being told that I needed to read one of the Gospels from cover to cover. We rewrote the parable of the Good Samaritan with machine guns and those kinds of things thrown in. But we never had to sit and read a Gospel from cover to cover. And even if I had done it age 9, I think I'd want to do it as an adult as well. Now, this worries me. Let me tell you why this worries me. It worries me because I meet people who express categorical opinions about the claims about Jesus in Dan Brown's book. They tell me with great confidence that they know that this or that is true or false. I then probe and I discover that they haven't read one of the Gospels that were written in the first century, one of the primary texts about Jesus Christ, as an adult. In fact, you probe a bit further and you find out that all they've read is the Da Vinci Code. Okay, now, we laugh, and I can laugh at that as well, but I need to say, I know I do that on other subjects. I'm quite ready to pontificate on all sorts of subjects about which I know absolutely nothing. And I think my wife thinks it increases my confidence when I do it. A little ignorance can help, can't it? To make you think strong things about something. But not on this issue, please. Because this issue is far too important for us to trade in ignorance like that. So I put this to you just because if that's you, when you got to this bit where he says that these Gospels were included by Constantine to downplay the human Jesus, and that there's this kind of stitch-up behind the inclusion of these Gospels. If you haven't read a Gospel with adult eyes, I just want to suggest to you that you're not in a position to have an opinion on that claim. There's nothing wrong with that. You can get an opinion, you can read it, you can think about it, you can do that. It's not that you're incapable of doing it. But if you haven't read a Gospel like that, then how can you possibly know whether he's right or wrong in what he says about them? So I hope that for at least a handful of people here this evening, Your next move on walking out this evening will be to get a gospel. In fact, you'll find one on your seat, a copy of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John on your seat, and to commit yourself to reading this from cover to cover with adult eyes. Because otherwise, I suggest to you, you have to ban yourself from having any opinions about who Jesus was. Now, if you do that, one of the very first and most obvious things that you will discover, and this is why it's so surprising, is that all of these Gospels clearly affirm the full and normal humanity of Jesus Christ. Think about what he does in the Gospels. He's born, he grows, he eats, he sleeps, he hungers, he thirsts, he is in agony, and finally he dies a bloody death. These are the things described in the Gospels that go into the New Testament. They don't look to me like the words of people trying to downplay the humanity of Jesus Christ. Think of the readings that if you're an occasional churchgoer, you might hear at Christmas. In the beginning was the Word, John's Gospel begins, verse 14, and the Word became flesh. Not quite the kind of thing you want to affirm if you're trying to deny the earthly, mortal, human Jesus. These are the claims of the Gospels that go in. Now, actually, there's a big irony here. The irony is that if anyone in the ancient world denies the full humanity of Jesus, it's not the Gospels that go into the New Testament, it's the Gospels that are kept out of it. It's those Gnostic Gospels that I mentioned earlier, and about which I'll say more later on. Again, anyone who knows anything about Gnosticism knows that Gnosticism is famous for teaching a view of Jesus which denies his full humanity. In fact, it even has a label. It's known as Docetism. It is one of the heresies of the early church. It is the denial that Jesus had a real human existence. One Gnostic text even depicts the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And it depicts the body on the cross being crucified in an agony. And then it describes the real Jesus standing over here to the side laughing. Because, of course, you can't crucify the real Jesus, according to the Gnostics, because he doesn't have a body that you could nail to the cross. This is the Gnostics denying the full humanity of Jesus Christ, not the four Gospels in the New Testament. Now, there's another irony with claim number four. Claim number four is the claim that Gnosticism was all about the sacred feminine. Do you remember this theme that runs through the book that I suspect many of the readers of the book find attractive? That there is this ancient, authentic strand of spirituality, this sacred feminine, which the church has suppressed. And the idea is that the Gnostics guarded this kind of spirituality. Now, again, I have to say I don't see how anyone who knows anything about Gnosticism can say this, because Gnosticism is known for being, overwhelmingly hostile to women. Let me give you a couple of examples again, simple examples. In one of the Gnostic systems, how do they explain the origin of evil in the world? Well, in the New Testament, in the Christian texts, the origin of evil is attributed to the sin of Adam by Paul in Romans 5. Who do the Gnostics blame? Not the man Adam, but the feminine spiritual power, Sophia. Sophia, this spiritual power, conceived an overwhelming desire for one of the higher spiritual powers. She longed for him, and she longed for him, and she longed for him, and in the end, her desire had to be cut off. And Sophia's desire plunged down out of the spiritual realm. And in the end, our material world was formed out of Sophia's severed desire. If that sounds weird, welcome to Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a pretty strange religious phenomenon. The point is simply this. In explaining the very origin of this evil material world itself, because the Gnostics hated matter, they hated the physical world, they blame the feminine spiritual power, Sophia. Let me give you one more example. One of the most famous Gnostic Gospels is the Gospel of Thomas, isn't it? It's the one that often comes up in the weekend newspapers. And the last verse of the Gospel of Thomas depicts a scene when Jesus is gathered with his disciples and with Mary Magdalene. Now, Mary Magdalene, of course, ought to be the hero of this Gnostic Gospel. She ought to get a really positive billing here. Well, what do we read? These are the words of saying 114 of the Gospel of Thomas, with which it closes. Simon Peter said to them, "Let Mary leave us, for women are not worthy of life." Jesus said, "I myself shall lead her in order to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every woman who will make herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." feminists. Indeed, you may well think. The mention of women, though, brings us a step closer to the woman at the heart of the Da Vinci Code and to the claim that she was married to Jesus. So let's begin with claim five, a general background claim, the claim that Jesus had to be married. So Brown writes, the social decorum during that time virtually forbade a Jewish man to be unmarried. According to Jewish custom, celibacy was condemned, and the obligation for a Jewish father was to find a suitable wife for his son. Now, the problem with this is that, contrary to the impression that Brown creates, there's very good precedent for a Jewish holy man being unmarried. Elijah would be an example, John the Baptist would be an example, around Jesus' time as well, the Essenes, that group possibly associated with the Dead Sea Scrolls, were renowned for their celibacy. Josephus and Philo, two prominent Jewish writers of the period, praised them for their celibacy. So there's good precedent for a Jewish holy man, which Jesus was, though he was more than that, being single. But even if in theory he didn't have to be married, maybe he was married. Okay, even if you can't prove that somebody has to be married, they might still be married. So what about the claim number six, the specific claim, that Mary Magdalene was married to Jesus? What's the evidence for that? Well, Brown makes a pretty bold claim for the evidence. The marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene is part of the historical record, he writes. Part of the historical record. Well, what's the evidence he has for this claim? He produces one piece of evidence from a book called The Gospel of Philip, which appears on the screen now. This is the text that he quotes to demonstrate the claim that Jesus and Mary were married. Let me read it to you in the form in which he quotes it at the top there. And the companion of the Saviour is Mary Magdalene. Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended by it and expressed disapproval. They said of him, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" Lee Teabing at this point comments, "As any Aramaic scholar will tell you, the word companion in those days literally meant spouse." So there it is, the description of Mary as the companion of the Saviour, the third word there, and the claim that this means that she was his spouse. Now, that's the only evidence that he cites, because that's pretty much the only evidence there is for the claim that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married from the ancient world. People may come up with later theories and speculations and texts such as the Priory of Zion ones, but in terms of the ancient evidence that's close to Jesus, this is it. Now, what can we say about this evidence? How good is it? Because, I mean, maybe if you could say, well, it's one decent bit of evidence, that would be enough by itself. Let me just tell you one thing to start with about the Gospel of Philip, and that is when it was written. The Gospel of Philip was written around about the year 250 AD. Now, this is not my slanted opinion. This is the opinion of a book, which I will show you later on if you want to see it, called the Nag Hammadi Library. It is the scholarly edition of the texts, of the Gnostic texts that were found in Egypt. So this isn't me who doesn't like Gnosticism. This is people who are pretty pro-Gnosticism, who like Gnosticism, saying this. Contrast the Gospels in the New Testament, written in the first century. I think there's a good argument for thinking that they were written before AD 70, but people disagree about that. There's good reason for thinking that Mark was written before AD 70, because the testimony of writers of the time is that it's based on the recollections of Peter, who died in the mid-60s. Now, put your historian's hat on for a moment and just ask yourself, which are you going to take more seriously? The Gospel of Philip, written around about the year 250, or one of the New Testament Gospels written in the same century as Jesus? But also, the way Brown quotes it at the top there isn't quite the whole story, because if you look at the form of it underneath, that is what the text that we have actually says. And it's a little bit different. What you will notice there is that there are some gaps. Now, again, if you look in the Nag Hammadi Library volume, you will see that these are the gaps in that edition of the text. In other words, this is what we actually have, as opposed to the form in which Dan Brown quotes it. Everything in square brackets represents some kind of uncertainty in the text. So let me reread it to you with the uncertainties put back in. And the companion of the blank Mary Magdalene, blank her more than blank the disciples, blank kiss her, blank on her, blank the rest of, blank. They said to him, "Why do you love her more than all of us?" Interesting, isn't it, in the film, that when Lee Teabing is reading this, Langdon cuts in just before he gets to the word mouth. Kiss her often on the mouth. because actually the word isn't in the text, and presumably they think they should back off a bit from putting words into the text that aren't there. I give that to you really just to say it's not quite as certain as Brown suggests it is it? It's a little more fragmentary and questionable than he thinks. I think if I would want to use the word naughty because it just conjures up pictures of cream cakes and things, doesn't it? But sort of misleading is probably the best word, isn't it, to describe the form in which he quotes it at the top. It is misleading. That isn't what it says. And then there's this word companion as well, which is a rather interesting word. The text of the Gospel is in Coptic, but the word used here, koinonos, is borrowed from the Greek language. So when he says that any Aramaic scholar will know this, he's just got the wrong language. He should be talking about Greek. And what do we know about the meaning of the word koinonos in Greek? Does it always mean spouse? Well, it doesn't. It just means an associate, someone associated with someone. In the New Testament, for example, koinonos is used to describe fellow businessmen, fellow fishermen. It's used even to describe fellow criminals or fellow murderers in the New Testament. It just means someone who has close association with someone. And therefore, Mary Magdalene being a follower and a close follower of Jesus Christ is all that you need to find in this word, in the description of her as Jesus' companion. But you might say, surely the kiss clinches it, because you understand the meaning of a word by its context, and in the context here, well, companion is being used in the context of kissing, so doesn't that suggest something rather more conjugal, more marital, more sexual? Well, no, it doesn't, because if you go back a little earlier in the Gospel of Philip to sections 58 to 59, you will find that the Gnostics are described as regularly greeting each other with this kind of kiss. It was just a standard Gnostic greeting. In short, there is absolutely no ancient evidence for the claim that Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene were married. Claim number seven, then, continuing the story a bit, is that the church then tries to demonize Mary in order to discredit her. We'll get rid of the Gospel of Philip for the moment. So the argument here is that because Mary has the secrets about Jesus, and because she was really this very close follower of Jesus, in fact, even his wife, the church needed to do something to write her off so that her testimony would have no credibility. Dan Brown writes, "The church, in order to defend itself against the Magdalene's power," makes her sound ominous, doesn't it, calling her the Magdalene, "perpetuated her image as a whore and buried evidence of Christ's marriage to her." Well, this again, I'm afraid, doesn't fit the evidence of history. Bear in mind that for Dan Brown, all of this conspiracy is meant to be designed by the Emperor Constantine in the 4th century. A small problem here is that Mary is not described as a prostitute until the year 591 by Pope Gregory in 591, way after the conspiracy has supposedly all happened. The New Testament itself does not call Mary Magdalene a prostitute. It doesn't describe her as a prostitute. How then did this idea occur? Well, it occurred as a way of reading a bit of Luke's gospel. You see, at the end of Luke chapter 7, we read of a prostitute being forgiven. And then at the beginning of Luke chapter 8, we're introduced to Mary Magdalene for the first time. And what happened was that people put two and two together and got what I think is five and concluded that the prostitute at the end of chapter 7 is the Mary who's introduced at the beginning of chapter 8. But that's all it is. It's a misreading of a text, not some great conspiracy theory. But let's for the moment pretend, and I want to underline that it is pretending, because I've just said that there is no picture of Mary as a prostitute in the New Testament, but let's pretend that the New Testament did say that Mary was a prostitute. Now, would this be a way of discrediting her? Well, let's think about some other people in the New Testament. Let's think about the Apostle Peter. What happens to Peter in the New Testament? He denies that he even knew Jesus Christ three times. He denies him. What about the Apostle Paul? What kind of a press does he get in the New Testament? He's depicted as persecuting the Christian church before he becomes a Christian. Now, are these facts given to us to discredit Peter and Paul? No, they're not. In fact, they have the opposite effect, because Peter then stands as an example of someone who has gone so far as to deny that he even knew Jesus Christ, and yet has been forgiven and restored by Jesus Christ. Paul stands as an example of someone who persecuted Christians, and yet whose life was turned around by Jesus Christ when he met him on the road to Damascus, when he appeared to him. So, having bad stuff about people in the New Testament isn't a way of writing them off. Were Mary Magdalene the prostitute in the New Testament, you would have to say, actually, she stands as a great example for Christians of how God can change a sinful woman's life like that. It wouldn't be a way of writing her off. In short, then, I suggest to you this evening that these seven central claims that Dan Brown comes up with about the Bible and Jesus and Mary stand on no secure historical foundation at all, and more, are contradicted by the positive evidence of history. Which, I think, rather makes you wonder, doesn't it? Doesn't it make you wonder, well, if that's the case, why are so many people so interested in it? Why is there such a level of enthusiasm for this book? And in particular, why do some people actually want to believe it, it seems? I know that won't be many here this evening, but there are people who are strongly convinced, and you may be this evening. What does it tell us, in other words, about the times in which we live that a book like this can be taken so seriously? Well, a couple of things. The first thing is something that the Bible itself tells us. There's a verse in the Old Testament which tells us that God has set eternity in the hearts of men and women. He set eternity in our hearts. What that means is that we are unavoidably religious creatures. Now, you may well think, well, that's not me. I'm not a religious creature here this evening. I consider myself to be an atheist, for example. But I mean to assert this, and this is what the Bible asserts, that we are all religious creatures. We all worship something in our lives. And if it isn't the true God, it will be someone or something else. It might be our own leisure, our own pleasure, our family and their well-being, our prosperity. It could all be good things like that that we turn into our gods and we worship them. Now, because God has set eternity in our hearts, we often have that gnawing sense that there is something more than the material around us. And we're therefore intrigued by and attracted by religious ideas. And I think that may explain what's going on with this novel, is that people have an inkling that there is something more. They like the idea of having a flavour of religion in their lives. And then they find this book gives it to them. It says interesting things about Jesus and Mary. It gets them thinking about Gnosticism and the feminine aspect of spirituality, etc., etc., etc. They think it may satisfy that longing. And then, secondly, why do people like Dan Brown's version specifically? Well, I suspect that people like Dan Brown's version because, yes, we are looking for something to worship in our lives, but actually, we often want it on our own terms, and we want a low-cost God in our lives, a low-cost God who won't make great demands of us. And I think, again, Dan Brown's religion, or the religion of the novel, as it is, offers us that. It offers us this flavour of spirituality running through our lives. But actually, if you believe it all, do you have to change much, do much, give up much, undertake much? No, not at all. You can just toy with it. It can entertain you. And you can have that flavour of religion without it disturbing who you are or how you live. Now, what I want to do as we close this evening is to ask a rather different question. Not what kind of religion does Dan Brown offer us, not to continue thinking about the Mary Magdalene of Dan Brown's account, but instead to turn to the New Testament for the last few minutes and to think about what the New Testament offers us, and in particular the Mary Magdalene of the New Testament. Now, I wish to say at the outset of doing this that this may be the point at which it gets a little more uncomfortable for some of you. And I'm not going to apologize for that, because what I'm going to do now is to plunge into some of the claims of the New Testament. And I need to warn you that contrary to what many people think, they are offensive claims. They are exclusive claims. We live in a determinedly pluralistic age. And for people living in that age, the New Testament, and including Jesus Christ himself, makes some pretty uncomfortable claims, and I'm not going to apologize for that. I take it that you've come out this evening because you're interested in what this book says, and in particular what it says about Jesus Christ, and that you will therefore recognize the importance of exposing yourself to the claims of the New Testament, even if they are uncomfortable, because if you are going to engage in a serious historical investigation of who Jesus Christ was, then you're going to need to look at the New Testament and its claims, because these are the ancient documents that describe who Jesus was. So I take it that at the least, you will bear with this as we do it this evening, but hopefully a lot more than that. So let's turn to the evidence of the New Testament, and let's ask then, Who was the real Mary Magdalene of history described in these authentic first century gospel texts? And what does she teach us today? A couple of pictures coming up. You will see there on the left-hand side, Mary in the New Testament sees Jesus die. And then on the right-hand side, you will see that Mary in the New Testament sees the risen Christ. The depiction on the right is the depiction of the risen Jesus Christ. That is a large part of her role in the New Testament, to be a witness of the cross and a witness of the resurrection. And what I want to do in our remaining moments this evening is to explain to you why that makes her very significant in the pages of the New Testament. And to do that, I need to explain to you why the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ are, according to the New Testament, the central events of human history. Now, you look fairly unmoved by that. It may be the heat. But that is a pretty shocking claim, if I say it again, isn't it? That the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ are the central events of human history. Not the discovery of fire, the invention of the wheel, the discovery of America or the internet or anything like that, but the death and resurrection of this one man. So that Mary seeing them gives her a very important role and tells us what the Mary of history would say to us today. So let's begin then with Jesus' death. Why is Jesus' death so important according to the New Testament? Why is Mary seeing that so crucial? Did anyone here see Mel Gibson's film The Passion of the Christ? Stick a hand up if you saw The Passion. Anyone see The Passion? Yeah, quite a few of you saw that film. I gather, because I didn't see it, but I gather that at the beginning, though it was quite quick, so apparently you shouldn't blink if you wanted to notice it, he put these words up on the screen. Does anyone remember this? Words from Isaiah the prophet. Let me read them to you. Written about 700 years before the birth of Jesus Christ. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Now, that film was quite controversial for various reasons, but insofar as Mel Gibson had those words projected on the screen at the beginning, he was absolutely right, because they're some of the most significant words in the Bible for explaining the meaning of Jesus' death. Let me give you a bit of vocabulary first, though, because I guess that the words like transgressions and iniquities aren't words that trip off your tongues. So what does the Bible mean when it talks about transgressions and iniquities, and then we'll explain these words here? Well, this takes us to one of the uncomfortable things that Jesus himself said. He taught that every human heart produces evil from within. And Bible words for that are words like sin or transgression or iniquity. The evil of the human heart. Now, again, that's a pretty provocative claim, isn't it? Because I guess we could all agree that there are evil people in the world. I think that's fairly uncontroversial, isn't it? We could probably produce a list of agreed, publicly recognized evildoers. And you may well say, yes, I know some evil people. I have to share a house with them, or they're in my office, or something like that. But Jesus doesn't actually mean that. He doesn't mean that those people over there that we all recognize as being evil are evil. He means that every individual in this room today produces evil from his or her heart. That is his astonishing claim, because we don't tend to think of ourselves like that, do we? How? How could he claim that? He doesn't mean that we're all rapists or murderers. He once told a story that you may recall of a son who goes to his father and asks for his inheritance. If your father's still alive, what would you be doing if you asked your father for your inheritance? What would you be wishing your father? You would be wishing him dead, wouldn't you? This son goes to his father and he wishes him dead and he wants his inheritance and he takes it and he heads out away from his father, away from the rule of his father, and he lives under his own rule, the way he wants, until he's squandered all of that wealth. Now, that is actually Jesus' picture of the universal human condition, the state that we are all in. That we all, like the son to the father, turn to God and say to him, no, we wish him dead, and we rebel against him, and we head out to live our lives our own way. That is what Jesus means when he says that our hearts produce evil from within, that they are rebellious against our Creator God. And I'm afraid that the news of the Bible gets worse than that, because the Bible also describes God as being a holy God. Now, you may well think of Jesus as being a gentle, mild man, and that is true, but it is also true that most of the references to hell in the New Testament come on the lips of Jesus Christ himself. He was unflinching in declaring that there will come a day when God will call every human being to account and when he will punish that rebellion against himself with everlasting punishment. That is what Jesus taught plainly. But the Bible goes on to say that God is not only a holy God, he is also a merciful God. That he doesn't will the death of his creatures, but that we should turn to him and live. And therefore he has provided a way back, so that where we have headed out and rejected him, we can come back and be reconciled to him as our Father. And that way is the death of Jesus Christ on the cross. So let me reread those words. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. What the prophet is saying 700 years or so before the event is that Jesus Christ would stand in the place of his people and bear for them the punishment that their rebellion against God deserved. And he would exhaust it in their place. Because of his love, he would bear it for them so that they could say that the punishment that brings them peace was upon him and that they have been healed by his wounds. Jesus Christ was the substitute who stood in the place of his people like that and bore the punishment that they deserved. Now, if you believe that here this evening already, then you will see why Mary Magdalene being a witness of the cross is no small thing indeed. She was a witness of that one event by which God has provided for us reconciliation with himself. This is the only way that he's provided, and she saw it with her own eyes. And then what happened next? Jesus' body was taken down, buried in the tomb on the third day, on the Sunday. Mary went to find it, and she found that his body was gone because he had been raised from the dead. And then we read this in Matthew's Gospel. So the women, having found the empty tomb, hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. This is very significant. It's significant that the first witnesses of the resurrection are women, because if you're going to invent an account of the resurrection, the last thing you do is have women as your first witnesses, because in the first century they didn't have any status as legal witnesses. It's a sign of the authenticity of the account. And so Mary, having met the risen Christ, then runs to tell the disciples. This is what we read in a verse in John's Gospel. Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news. "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he'd said these things to her. So Mary is a witness of the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So what? I guess it's pretty amazing that a man rose from the dead. But why is it that amazing that this is the central event of human history? Well, notice her words there. "I have seen the Lord." Notice how she uses that title for God from the Old Testament, that Jesus is Lord. Mary knew that by raising him from the dead, God had installed Jesus Christ as Lord of the whole creation, as King of the whole universe. This is another one of the astonishing claims of the New Testament, that Jesus Christ is the only supreme ruler of the entire universe. And Mary was one of the first two witnesses of this. She saw it. Now, does this not make Mary a very important person in the pages of the New Testament? Indeed. I want to suggest in closing that it makes no sense to think that she's been sidelined or written off in the New Testament when she stands as a witness of the crucifixion of the Son of God, a witness of that one means that God has ordained by which we can come back to him and be reconciled to him. And it makes no sense to think that she's been marginalized when she's a witness of the resurrection of the Son of God from the dead, the event in which he is exalted as Lord of the whole earth, Lord of my life and Lord of your life. So what would the real Mary say to us then, as we close, if she were here this evening? The Mary of history, the Mary of the four Gospels from the first century, what would she say to us? I don't think that she would say to us, "Do you know, I was his wife. I had his children. You'll find them in France if you go and look." I think instead that the real Mary would say to us, "Why don't you do what I did? Why don't you come to the cross of Jesus Christ with all of your rebellion against God and lay that rebellion at his feet and receive from him full forgiveness?" And I think she would say to us, "And will you not also do what I did and bow down and worship the risen Jesus Christ as the Lord of your life?" I'm very aware that those are bold claims to make for who Jesus was. They are the claims of the New Testament. I want to give you a good chance to ask questions about them and about anything else that I've said this evening about Dan Brown's history. You may want to ask questions about Leonardo or Constantine or anything like that. But do also think about the most provocative, surely what is the most provocative part of what you've heard this evening, which is the version of Jesus Christ that you get in the ancient authentic Gospels. So we're going to take a break now. And you take up your bits of paper, people will be collecting them in, and then we do this just because it allows people who wouldn't want to ask a question in a group this size to ask a question. It also allows me to sequence the questions into some kind of order, and if any of my Christian friends here write me a little sermon, which happens occasionally, it allows me to remove it and take the more sceptical and searching questions instead. So we'll take a break in which you can write down your questions. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. That's fantastic. Thank you very much for all these questions. We've gathered together a representative sample. There are some still left upstairs. I will do my best, though I will enjoy this, to keep Gary to time, keep him moving through these questions. Can I say straight away at the beginning, though, as perhaps a sort of frustration subduing method, can I just draw your attention to these Christianity Explored flyers, which should be on your chair? We don't expect even someone as bright as Gary will not answer in depth every single one of the questions we've been asked this evening. And there should be on your chairs information about a course that we run here that is designed specifically for questions. Chance for you to bring those questions and many others, talk them through over much more time. Thank you very much. And a chance to look at those around a group together. So please do have those in hand. But let's start in, Gary, if you're ready, on some of these. If Mary Magdalene was so important to the full witness and account of Jesus' life and death and resurrection, why has her gospel been marginalized and discredited? And then some other questions about the New Testament more generally. Things like this. Isn't it possible that someone writing about this talk this evening, 75 years from today, might even misquote Gary? What about the New Testament if there's a gap like that? Isn't it possible the gospels may have mistakes in them? That sort of thing.
Thank you, Chai. There were a lot of questions in the pile like this, saying that really the big issue is the reliability of the Gospels in the New Testament. And I'm very aware that that is a question that I didn't really address in the talk. It's a sort of hole in the middle of the talk, in that I gave you some sustained criticism of Dan Brown's version of history. I then moved to explaining the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ on the basis of the New Testament, but didn't give you any reasons for the reliability of the New Testament, or why one might think that the New Testament Gospels are reliable. So I'm aware there is a gap there, and that's part of the frustration of one evening, why you can't do it, or why those groups would be so good if you do want to pursue those questions. I would also say that because people had asked that question quite a lot, in the middle of my little book, and I'm not trying to sell it to you because my salary is perfectly adequate to live on, but in the middle of that, aware that that's a question that comes into people's minds, I've put a long section on the reliability of the Gospels, trying to give some reasons. To give you headlines, the argument there first addresses the reliability of the manuscript tradition for the New Testament, which compared to other ancient texts is very, very strong. Secondly, it talks about the nature of first century Jewish culture and methods of learning, and in particular the practices of rabbis. Jesus' followers called him a rabbi. And I argue there that the kind of way in which Jesus taught and the practice of his followers, if it reflected normal rabbinic practice, would have been all about the accurate preservation of his teaching. So whereas you may come here and have no particular interest in the accuracy of an account of this evening that you might give in 75 years' time. In the first century Jewish culture, where they're sitting at the feet of a rabbi, the preservation of the rabbi's teaching is the crucial issue for them. And so what we need to do is not to ask, is it conceivable that somebody giving an account of this talk, this evening in our culture, could get it so wrong, but what was the culture of the first century like? And we also need to remember that I'm not sure quite so where the figure of 75 years has come from. The figure is probably more like 30 years, though that's until we have the Gospels in the final written form that we have them in. We have Paul's letters from much earlier than that in the New Testament attesting the same beliefs about Jesus Christ. And if the Gospels are based on earlier written accounts and the preaching of eyewitnesses, then again, the actual sources go back much earlier. But that's a big issue there. I'd encourage you to take it seriously if it's a question you have. And at least as a next step, maybe to look in that section of my book, sign up for one of the courses and come and ask that question and spend more time on it.
Thank you, Gary. Just the actual question was about Mary's Gospel as well.
Mary's Gospel isn't Mary's Gospel, is the simple answer to that. Mary's Gospel is written well after the death of Mary Magdalene. Even the most positive people about it think it's in the second century. In the later second century, actually the manuscripts don't attest that. Essentially, it's just not Mary's Gospel.
Thank you. A question then about some of the claims of the New Testament. One here about Jesus' death. Is it historically plausible that Jesus didn't die physically, that he didn't die?
Thank you. In part, I'd want to know why somebody thinks that he didn't die physically. This may be somebody's read the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, because the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail book doesn't only claim that Jesus was married and had descendants, but it also claims that he didn't die on the cross. And if that's what's in your mind, you may well remember that they have an argument for this position, which is that when Joseph asks for Jesus' body from Pilate, they say he uses a Greek word which always denotes a living body in Greek. And they say this is a bit of a giveaway, that even in the New Testament itself, a Greek word is used in the request for Jesus' body, which would always describe a living body. So he knew that Jesus was still alive. Well, I read this, and I thought, that sounds a bit strange. So I went to my Greek dictionary, my sort of basic Greek dictionary, pulled it off the wall, and found that the first entry for soma, the word that's used, says that Homer, the ancient Greek poet, consistently used this word to refer to corpses, dead bodies. And then I thought, well, maybe the New Testament does something a bit different. So I looked in the New Testament use of it, and there is a description of vultures on a soma, on a corpse, on a dead body. And so if that's the argument you have in mind there, it's a particularly poor one, which arises, it seems to me, from a complete ignorance of how Greek is used. And then, of course, there's the positive evidence that Jesus was dead. For example, the separation of water in his body when his body was pierced, that's described in John's Gospel, which is apparently a medical phenomenon that occurs on death. And that is evidence that he was dead. There are many more things we could go into.
Thank you very much, Gary. Now, there are a lot of questions here about Jesus. If Jesus was fully human, surely he would have had sexual or relational feelings. If he acted on them, would it change who he is? Would it stop him being God's perfect, sinless person? And similarly, did Jesus have a child? Did Jesus have sex, basically?
In one sense, the answer to this question is clearly he could have done. He couldn't have sinned, and extramarital sex would have been a sin, and so he wouldn't have done that. But could he have been married and had sex and had children? Well, given that the New Testament affirms his full humanity, given that he could hunger and thirst and weep and bleed and die, he could have been married and had sexual relations with his wife. So in that sense, the answer is yes, he could have done. Could he have done that and still done what he came to do? Well, if he came into the world to die on the cross in the place of his people, to pay the price for their sins, to rise again as Lord, could he have done that and been married? I suppose he could have done, but I think it would have been an odd thing for him to do, given his purposiveness and the single-mindedness with which he came and that he knew he was coming to die. He described at one point in Matthew's Gospel how some people become eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. I don't think he means that they emasculate themselves. I think it's a figure of speech for singleness. And I think that's a description of himself. Because of his single-minded purpose in coming to die, he maintained his singleness. It's also interesting that Paul, at one point in one of his letters, tries to defend the claim that he could marry if he wanted to. And he cites various Christian leaders who were married in trying to prove the case for the possibility of him being married if he wants to be married. It seems to me that if Jesus had been married, he would have had a total knockdown argument, which is, the Lord himself was married. How can you possibly stop me being married? And he doesn't say that. He never goes there because he knew that Jesus wasn't married. So in a sense, he could have done as a full human being, but would he have done? No. And did he? No.
Thank you. Questions about some of the artwork in Dan Brown's novel. One about the Last Supper. How do you explain the woman sitting next to Jesus?
Thank you. I was aware that I didn't say much about Leonardo, as we should call him, in the talk. So just coming up here is the next one. We'll keep trying. There we go. I should have gone the other way. Here's the picture, if you can see it. Can you see that? Is that a vaguely discernible figure here? At the side of Jesus, this figure here is meant to be very feminine, and this shows us that it's a woman. Dan Brown says, so that's a woman. There's the M shape that tells us it's Mary. And notice here there's no single grail on the table, just lots of little cups. That's going to disappear now. Now, that's the argument then. If you're persuaded by that, go home, look in Google, and look up Leonardo da Vinci, John the Baptist. I think you'll find a couple of paintings of John the Baptist, which he said were paintings of John the Baptist. One of them you'll find, well, think about John. John the Baptist, if you recall him, is a pretty hairy guy who lived in the wilderness and ate unpleasant things. He's a man's man, really, John the Baptist. Look at this picture of John the Baptist. You will find the most stunningly beautiful, effeminate John the Baptist you can imagine. Why? Because that's how Leonardo painted men. He was charged with a homosexual offence in his early years, though he was cleared of it. Perhaps he liked painting effeminate men. Why is there no single cup? Well, apparently in a third of paintings of the Last Supper between 1300 and 1500, there is no single cup. It was a normal way of painting the Last Supper. And in fact, if Jesus was observing what appears to have been the normal Jewish practice of the day, there would probably have been four cups at the Last Supper anyway, not one. So there are no secret signals in the painting, I'm afraid.
What about the voting? Why did bishops need to vote about whether Jesus was God or not?
A question arises here, doesn't it? If they weren't doing this to revise the belief, to get rid of Gnosticism, etc., etc., why were they doing it? Well, they were doing it because of a heresy called Arianism. Following the teachings of a man called Arius, people had increasingly denied the divinity of Christ, which had been affirmed in the New Testament and by people like Ignatius of Antioch that I quoted earlier on. But there was the growth of this movement called Arianism, and so they needed to deal with it. And in particular, because the emperor had become a Christian, he was concerned for unity in the church because it would be reflected in unity in his empire. So he got them all together and said, look, we've got to sort this out and clarify where we stand on Arianism. So it was against Arianism. It didn't really have anything to do with the Gnostics at all.
Thank you. I think probably just time for one or maybe two more. What would an interested party looking into the claims of Christ, what would they have to do to worship the Lord the way you said that Mary Magdalene did?
So Mary Magdalene bowed down and worshipped the risen Christ. What would somebody have to do? If this were you this evening, what would you have to do? You would need to be clear, first of all, that you understand what you're doing in doing that. The last thing I would want is for somebody to come to a talk like this and make an ill-informed, rushed decision about something and think, right, that's it, on the basis of misunderstanding and ignorance. So you need to be clear that you have understood what the claims of the Christian gospel are, that Jesus Christ is the one by whom we can be reconciled to the Father, that he died on the cross as the one sacrifice for sins, that God is a holy God, that you are a sinner, that you are produce that evil from within, and that he is your rescuer, and then to submit to him as Lord, in other words, to surrender the entirety of your life to him with no corners kept back, to submit to his reign over your life, and to trust in him as your Saviour and your Lord is what it would mean. So you need, first of all, to be clear that you understand what you're doing. Maybe coming to a group would be a good thing to do, or talking to somebody you know who's a Christian, to clarify what you're doing, and then to do that, and to do that in the form of praying to God, of confessing your rebellion against him, of placing your trust in Jesus' death on the cross, and submitting yourself to his lordship over your life. Those would be the things that you would need to do. I would encourage you to go away and read through a gospel, to think through what you're doing, and then to take that step, if that is you, here this evening.
Thank you. Can I push you slightly harder on that? What would you as a, obviously a man's man, but as a dry, academic, analytical brain, what would you say is your heart experience of that? What is it to have done that to Jesus?
I grew up in a non-Christian home. My mother's a Christian now, my father isn't. I knew very little of the claims of Jesus Christ. I've probably been to church about four times in my youth, but I did come under an increasing conviction that that I had done evil things in my life. I then started reading John's Gospel at A-level, and I discovered the most extraordinary news, that God is a God of love and that reconciliation with him is possible. So my experience is that you can have an acute awareness of your sin and your rebellion against God and the plight in which it places you and the desperateness of your state, and you can come to Jesus Christ and know that you have received complete cleansing and forgiveness. And that is the most extraordinary thing. So many people go through their lives with, just in terms of their human relationships, burdens of guilt. Then when you come to understand that against your Creator God, you're living in that kind of rebellion. And to know that that is forgiven and removed is a most marvelous thing. So taking off the dry historian's hat, I'd say that's what it's about. And then living under his lordship and his reign, his perfect rule for you, is the most excellent way to live a human life. And it's your only hope when Jesus Christ returns.
Gary, thank you very, very much. You've given us your time here. Thank you for dealing with those questions under the hot spotlights on a Tuesday evening in the city. Gary, he hasn't quite said he's willing to stay until the last question is answered, but is planning to be around for a bit. Please do come and grab Gary. I know we went through those very quickly. Gary will be loitering around wherever his strawberries have been saved for him. Come and get him near the front. But Gary, thank you. Thank you very much. Do grab a seat. As Gary said, please do take with you the Gospels that were on your seat. Take those away and read them if you would. There are all different sort of colours, different Matthew, Mark, Luke and John on your chairs. Do swap with your neighbours if you want the full set or don't like the one that you were given. In the marquee on your way out, you'll find some books and CDs that may be helpful. The CDs are free, completely free to any guests here. This evening, we normally like to say that the regulars at St. Helens, please don't clean us out. You can pay like you normally do. But these are all free if you're here as a guest. There's one on MP3 that has on it a load of talks answering other questions that people often have. Why is there suffering? Questions about other religions. What's going on with that? Questions about sex. So do grab hold of one of those. Or on normal audio CD, there'd be some talks about Jesus, or some talks about forgiveness, the kind of thing Gary's just been talking about. Do pick up one of those. There are also some books, as we mentioned, Gary's book at half price. Gary's pamphlet, only £1, available at the back. Also, though, you might like to get hold of for £5, but I'm sure someone here would buy it for you if you wanted it. It's a book called A Fresh Start. And I guess just goes through the experience of being forgiven by Jesus, how that happens, what it is to be forgiven and given a fresh start by Jesus. If you're someone who wants to do some serious thinking, maybe on your own, might be good to take this away as well of one of the Gospels. We'd love, though, for you to come back to Christianity Explored if you're interested. It starts on Wednesday next week. Wednesday next week, if you were to write an email address and a phone number down inside one of these, there are some black bins by each of the doors on the way out for you to put that in, and someone will be in touch with you, give you the details. Wednesday evenings, we meet in groups for some food to look at the claims of Christianity, sort of one per week pretty much, and a chance to discuss things more, and also to look through one of those accounts of Jesus' life. We look through Mark's Gospel. I think, is that in red? Is that right? So if you're interested in that, it's in purple, sorry. Then make sure, steal it from your neighbour, make sure you get Mark's Gospel to read through and come back to Christianity Explored. Otherwise, thank you very much for being with us. We hope that you would come back and see us again. We meet every Tuesday and Thursday lunchtimes here in the city, and also on Sundays. Our church meets at 10:15 and at 7 o'clock on a Sunday. So please do come back and join us again. There is more to drink, more to eat. Please do stay around and chat more. I know there's a pub just there that may be showing the second half of Germany, Italy, if that's interesting as well. But please do stay as long as you'd like to.